Hello, good evening and welcome to this month's Podrophenia. As it's Easter, we are offering you a slightly different flavour of the show. A full 2 hours in-depth interview covering all aspects of his career, from his first band Drill playing the Top Alex in Southend, touring with Slade, touring the world with Adam Ant, right through to recent projects The Wolfman, The Mutants, 1000 Motels and Rude Girl. Please sit back and enjoy Podrophenia in conversation with Chris Constantino.
Here is a box, a musical box, wound up and ready to play. But this box can hide a secret inside. Can you guess what is in it today?
This is Podrophenia with Piley and Mondo.
We'll Oh, look at that. What a way to open up the old, set up your stall, that is, isn't it? Belter, walloper, and hat popper completely. Huge salute
we
to...
We get a walloper alarm, didn't we? We kept talking about that. So
I think that would
be going off, wouldn't it, right now?
I think it'd be a meltdown. It exploded. It popped itself clean off the shelf, wouldn't it? So that was amazing. We should give a hat tip all round, a tip of the Podronic salute. First to Phil Hubbs for his fantastic jingle work there, as always, king of the jingles. And, of course, to our special guest. Go on, Paddy, you'd say?
I was going to say, we're treading a risky tightrope, aren't we, with the old Hubbs? We're giving him thanks now before we've even heard it. He could be having a write-off.
Stiffness right up. But we've got to say a huge salute to Chris Constantino, who joins us for our special tonight. It's up to his third or fourth appearance. Again, another one who's due for a match ball.
Yeah. So, I don't know.
Absolute fortune.
Nice to be with you in, where are you, Leon C?
In Lee pretty much, aren't we? Lee Westcliff, all across the sort of, the south end of the sea. Days. Yeah, exactly. All on the coast.
I love it down there. I love it.
You used to come down?
I used to know a girl from down that way.
Tread carefully. Tread carefully.
Yeah.
But you used to play on the subject of South End, and you played at the Alex here, didn't you? The Top Alex.
Alex, yeah.
With one of your first bands.
The Drill. We came down there, and it was like, it's like sort of. We had an agent. I think it was our first agent, and they said, "Oh, we've got you a gig at the Top Alex," and there was this bloke, a roadie called Will from Easy, who said he'd drive us down there. And we got down there. We didn't know what to expect, really. And then there was a fight. And then and our singer, Will, jumped in the audience and punched someone and then sort of jumped back up again. It was a sort of,
typical drill gig.
Moody pub, wasn't it, that?
It used to be a bit of a biker's pub. Yeah, it used to be a bit of a biker's pub. Where was that on the Drill timeline? Was that sort of early days, late days, middle period?
I think it was early period because it was like the first. It might have been our first gig.
Never.
Yeah. Because Panics might have been our first gig.
Blimey! What a way to sort of pop your drill cherry, so to speak, down at the top of Alex.
Yeah.
Well, I never heard about that. Yeah, it had a moody rep for years. There was a lot of snooker cue fights in there and stuff like that, wasn't there?
Dr. Feelgood used to play there a lot, didn't they?
Dr. Feelgood, Wilco played there a lot.
Yeah.
Yeah, he used to play there a lot.
I found the poster, of when we played there and who was playing at the night before. Did I send you that?
No, I haven't seen that. I'd have to say that. That'd be brilliant.
Yeah, I found it. So I started looking up, because, I'm doing my books. So I started looking up bits and pieces, and so I found Top Alex and who was playing there, and then I found, because we were playing in the East London, where was that Iron Maiden they used to play? Bridge House?
That was, somebody can in town, wasn't it?
Yeah, the Bridge House. So I was trying to find it when Iron Maiden and all the other bands were playing there at the same, so I've sort of been doing my homework and all that stuff. But the Top Alex, South End.
They're amazing.
It was a rude awakening.
Have you had any other trips into the area for to play, Chris? Or was it any other sort of like... We did have a lot of venues around here over the years, but...
I think... I'm trying to remember. I mean, I think... I think that... Yeah, there was another venue. I'm trying to think what it was called, though. I can't remember. But I've been down there. I mean, I had a few friends down there, so I used to pop down there. Leon C, and sort of here's a few stories which I probably can't go into.
with your posters and memory, how much have you kept? Have you kept everything, or have you ditched a load of stuff?
I've pretty much got loads of stuff. I'm just going through it. It's like my whole studio is full of all this stuff, and I'm just going through it. It's like, oh, bloody hell, you find this, it's like this poster of, this, and then diaries of this, and there's some things that I've burned.
Oh, really?
Years ago, I kind of like had a moment, and I thought maybe this would be the best for everyone if I burnt these bits of, diaries and photographs. I mean, this is sort of before hard drives and stuff like that. So,
of course.
Yeah. So.
And what about sort of gig, like clothes you used to have and sort of band gear and stuff like that, or equipment?
Yeah, I've still got loads. I've got a lot of band, you know, band stuff, old band stuff, equipment. I always just use my Fender, my old Fender Precision Bass.
That crops up on sort of single sleeves and it's in the videos. Is that still, am I right in thinking that's the first one you had?
No, it isn't the first one I had, but it's the second one I had. The first one I had was kind of like, I really liked it because it was like a slinky, I had a Fender Jazz first.
Mm.
I had a Fender Jazz and then I had a Gibson Triumph, and then I got the Fender Precision and I still got the manual, you know, the little thing that it came with.
Yeah, of course. Yeah.
I've got the little book.
How many years service has that been now from that base?
Probably, let's think, a long time, I don't know, maybe sort of 40 years or something, 40, maybe 43, 44 years.
That's a good investment, isn't it? That was a good buy. You've had your value for money out of that, haven't you?
Yeah, no, it was really good. I still got the receipt. I had to pay for it in a few goes.
Oh, I see, right.
And I went down to the music shop and...
Where was this, in Plymouth or in London?
In Plymouth, and there was a bloke called Mike who used to work there, and he was like an old-timer, jazzer. And he said, oh, you know, well, you're going to have to do it in installments. And so I had a little sort of book and used to go in and give him his money.
HP?
It was not H. It was just like sort of go in whenever you've got some money and give it to him. Sort
do
of
that. Thing. That's amazing. You know, I hate to break this, but he's probably out of warranty now, though, if anything goes wrong with it.
It's been through a lot, so you know, it's still going.
Yeah.
Have you ever collected anything sort of random while I was thinking like old Dave Nev the other day, he put up his collection of sugar cubes, you know, and you used to get like the individually wrapped sugar cubes, and he had them going back since the 80s. And I know someone who everywhere they played on tour, they'd get like them snow globe things.
Oh, yeah.
It was by one of those, or a fridge magnet or something like that. Is there any sort of random stuff you've ever sort of picked up while you're on tour or got on the bus for?
Probably. I've got bits and pieces that I've sort of, when I'm looking through all my stuff, I go, oh, where's that from? And then, you know, it's like, but I wasn't like a sort of, I'll get something from every gig, which I should have. But you know, I didn't think it would last more than one more gig. You know, it was like kind of like, you know, we've got through tonight.
What about set lists, things like that? Have you collected those?
I've got loads of set lists. Funny enough, I've got set lists from my first gig ever, sort of.
And, wow, really?
Yeah,
well, set to lists. Keep that.
Yeah, and you know, sort of like. Diaries from way back when we were supporting bands like Sassafras and Snafu, and I don't know if you
were they sort of like the sort of pub rocky type bands.
Yeah, they were really. they were quite bad sometimes, but you know, it was like
Was this when this was in the drill days?
No, this was before.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, this was like school days. You know, just sort of, you know. Just after leaving school, so
And then you hooked up with Drill, and you were managed, or was your produced by Chaz Chandler? Yeah.
He managed and produced us. We went to what was that studio? Is it I'm trying to remember what it's called now? The one in Portland Square? Is it IBC or something?
I don't know that one.
IBC Studios. Yeah, it was his studio. He bought it, and it's where Hendrix and all those bands recorded and. So it was, it was like, to me, it was a massive, I mean, you know, when you go into this studio, you just know, you just sort of sense this is, you know, and then he said, oh, this is where Hendrix used to sit and do his stuff and, you know, blah, blah, blah. And, you know, I was just like, to me, I mean, forget the recording. It was just like Hendrix, talking about Hendrix, you know, going in and do Wing Christ Mary, he wrote, you know, wrote the lyrics in the toilet on a bit of toilet paper, came back in, all that stuff, you know, hearing about Hendrix for me was, And obviously, Chaz Chandler was like so down to earth.
Oh, of course, yeah, yeah. I guess, yeah, I didn't realise, yeah. And this must be weird because, you know, having been in the band, I guess you get all the info and the stories from him and stuff like that. He could give you all the nods on what, like, say, what happened where in the studios and stuff, couldn't he? You know?
Yeah, no, it was brilliant. And he was like really sort of, you know, as I say, Dan, you know the story about the sausage sandwiches, but you know.
Oh, go on, what's this?
Like, oh, the sausage sandwich story. Oh, well, because he was like, he came in and we were kind of like very sort of, you know, we were just sort of expecting some big time producer to tell us what to do, you know. And he just said, well, you know, hold on, I'm just going to play this in. He just said, basically, right, lads. And he ordered like two sausage sandwiches. This is like, we got there at 11 in the morning. IBC Studios, Portland place. And we got there and he ordered two sausage sandwiches, one with red sauce and one with brown sauce. And he got a copy of The Sun and he put his feet up on the desk. And he said, all right, lads, he says, get on with it. And he goes, if anything stops me from eating my sandwiches, I know it's wrong. He says, I know it doesn't look. And he said, it looks like I'm not producing and I'm not doing my job. But he said, this is always works for me. So just get on with it sort of thing. So we kind of just all sort of, you know, just got on with it. And then he just kept on eating his sandwiches. And then, you know, reading the paper.
Yeah.
And then as soon as anything, like, he didn't like anything, he stopped. And he said, okay, that's rubbish. And he says, right, we'll scrap that, do that again. But it was like, you know, really sort of like very down to earth. And, you know, we'd all, Ed Slade used to come in the studio, we'd go to the pub. they were funny.
Were they really? You cross paths with them quite a bit then, Slade?
Yeah, we toured with them, didn't we? Quite a lot.
Of course, yeah, yeah.
Because we met up with them in the studio and there was a, sorry, just going to find it. But we went to the, there was a pub in the back of the Muse where, and they used to come up and sort of go in, you still there?
Yeah, we're still there.
So just check these headphones. Mm. So we'd end up sort of going into this pub around the back of the Muse and, they'd be all taking the piss out of us, you know, and just going, oh, you fucking wankers, you know, you think you're going to do it like that. And then they said, oh, do you want to come on tour with us? And we said, but you just said we're wankers. And he said, yeah, I've only winded you up, you know, come on tour with us. So we went on tour with them and they were like, honestly, it was so funny because our guitarist had one of those little Watkins amps. I don't know if you remember those.
Yeah. Like, well, you'd mic that up.
And we put it on a chair.
Yeah.
We put it on a top of something. What's the guitarist called? Was it Jimmy? No, not Jimmy. It's Dave, wasn't it? The guitarist was
Dave
called
Hill.
Oh, Dave Hill. Yeah. With a Super Yop guitar. Yeah.
Yeah. So he would come out and he'd have all these sort of Marshall specs, like massive Marshall specs, and he'd be playing. And then the whole band would come out and laugh at him and go, look, that guitarist is better than you. And they'd take the piss out of him and go, look, he's only got a Watkins amp. So it was just really funny. They would really take the piss out of us and we'd take the piss out of them. We'd end up, you know, backstage all over the, all, you know, supporting them, and we'd end up backstage. And you know what it's like when you're supporting a band like that, you're kind of, you've got drinks, you've got nothing.
Mm.
And then they would just share everything with us, even the groupies, you know, you have nothing. So it'd be like, come on, new boys, you know.
That's brilliant. That's amazing. They really looked after you.
Yeah, they did. They were really good.
Are you still in touch with any of them, or is that sort of dropped away now?
I haven't seen any of them for ages. I'd love to. I mean, maybe now's a good time. I don't know who's still, they're probably all still alive, aren't they?
I think one died, didn't he? Didn't one of them die?
Yes.
I think one of them, the drummer or the... Dave Hill's, I think the two, Dave and, what's his name, Noddy are still around, aren't they?
Dave and Noddy are safe.
Yeah, I think, yeah, that's right. I think it's one of the other ones. I can't remember which one it was. The drummer or the bass player.
Don, is it?
Yeah, it might be Don or the bass player. I can't remember.
He had some health problems, didn't he?
Don had already, he'd had a serious car accident.
Yes.
And and he couldn't taste or smell anything, which he used to say was an advantage in some situations, which I won't go into. But and you know, he was just very sort of funny about
that. That's brilliant.
Yeah, he was great.
Don Powell's still going.
He's still going.
He got chucked out of Slade last year.
Oh no!
Well, they chucked him out. They chucked him out a few times because his memory had gone. So he couldn't remember.
He just kept coming back.
Well, yeah, no, exactly. Yeah, that's funny. But on the soundcheck, no, they used to play the new song, over and over again, and because he had to learn it, and then they sort of eventually just chuck it in the set. Once he played it live, he got it. But they were a solid band. They were
amazing. And a bit of an over. We said before that in Podrick, a bit of an overlooked influence because you've got Kiss and Ramones, all influenced by him. Took stuff from Slade, huge influence on, you know, massively strong songs, big sort of terrace anthems as well, aren't they? But
that bass sound was amazing. Honestly, I mean, that bass sound he got, you know, it was just incredible.
When we opened up, let's backtrack a little bit. We opened up with Darla Mendy as well. I'm sure I pronounced that wrong because I worked with an Asian bloke once and I was saying about Darla Mendy. He said, he didn't know what I was talking about. He says like Darla or something like
you
that.
You go Dala or Darla. And I, you know, in India and everywhere I go, they pronounce it in a way that I can't pronounce it.
That's right.
I say Darla Mendy. Yeah. And then they go, oh, who's that? And you go, Dala. Ah. Dale,
exactly. That's right. I was talking about it until I wrote it down and showed him. He said, "Oh my God, like, he's as big as George Michael out here. He was huge."
He's huge.
I've just made the new headphones. I heard some proper old, you know, busy bass parts going on in that track just now that I perhaps hadn't picked out before. Quality stuff.
Yeah.
So where does that fit into your sort of timeline? Because that was around the Wolfmen period, yeah.
Yeah, I think it was the beginning. It was right at the beginning, I think. It was like,
is it?
Yeah, because we did, I think that was before we even recorded any of our own stuff.
All right.
Yeah, no, it was early days. So we'd, yeah.
There's two tracks, aren't there? You've got that one, Thieves and Liars, and then there was Two Eyes, was the sort of really fast, punky one. Was there anything that never got sort of made the final edit or never came out?
Yeah, I'll send you. I've got a whole album. I'll send you the link. It's got the whole album. Yeah. It's put out.
Why is that? Why did it?
Copy.
Oh, there we go.
Wow.
Look at that.
You got it. Amazing.
Look at that. Look, that's all Wolfman, that is.
Oh, is it?
Bloody hell.
I got more than you got, Chris.
I know.
I've got a t-shirt somewhere upstairs. I've got a glittery t-shirt upstairs somewhere. So
you got the Karma Sutra one?
I've got the one with the sort of like the man in the, you know, the Leonardo da Vinci thing with the wolf's head.
Oh, right. I've got a Wolfman t-shirt. You haven't got this one, though.
I haven't got that one. No, it's glitter on my one. Yeah. Oh, look at that.
Oh, that glitter one. I lost mine.
Oh, there we go. It's not me. I've got...
Did you come to the Angel show?
Was that the first one?
Yeah.
Yeah, that was amazing. That was the first. That's where I first met Eugene from Viva.
That's where Bishy, you know, we did actually play Two Eyes, didn't we? All Thieves.
That's right. And I met her again at another do later on. We met up later on, about a couple of years later. I met up with Bishy, bumped into her somewhere. But yeah, that's right. Yeah, you opened with Needles in the Camel's Eye.
That was it, yeah. With Stephen Pook did a little documentary on it. But
that's right.
Yeah, Darla Mendy, that Thieves and Liars, honestly, I think it's like one of the best tracks of sort of ever.
It's amazing. You know? You were saying, Stephen, weren't you? Stephen was in the mission control there, in the control tower. You hadn't heard that before, I don't think, had you, Stephen?
I heard that before. I thought that was absolutely superb. It properly romped along. Very good.
How did you go about writing that? Does he come up with the top line, or do you give him the music first, and or do you fit around him?
He sent, so the way it worked was he sent us the top line.
Mm.
And then we just took out everything apart from the Indian doll, you know, called doll drums. We just maybe left some of that in. And then we just wrote all these chords around it. So because what he sent us was just like a lot of everything he does is just like on one note. And it's just, so we just sort of wrote what you'd like, you know, in a punk Western sort of song around it. Yeah, no, I don't know how it worked, but it does, doesn't it?
Oh, it's amazing. And he turned up at the studio, didn't he? He popped into Razor Studio in Putney for a while.
Yeah, he came down to because he came over and it was like he was just going to do, I don't know, he was around and he came down to the studio and he sat there. I was sitting outside, it was summer, and I just, you know, through the haze, I just saw this sort of like, you know Wandsworth.
Yeah, yeah.
We used to record that car park, and there's that police place next door, the surveillance place.
Yeah.
It's very sort of, you know, urban. Sort of
it always, just a bit, yeah, yeah. It's a nice road to get there, but when you get there, it's like an industrial estate, isn't it?
Industrial estate. Yeah. And suddenly I saw in the distance, I saw this guy, like, with all these robes, sort of walking, you know, like this, from the east, you know, someone with a, you know, whole gang of people,
yeah.
People carrying things. And
really regal looking.
Yeah, and it was like, you know, servants and all this stuff. And he just sort of came up and he said, oh, you must be Chris. I said, yes, you must be Dollar. And then he sort of came in. He sat there, he didn't say anything for hours. And we thought, oh, my God, he must hate it. And then suddenly he just put his hand up and he stood up. He said, I sing now. And yeah, and he just got up and he went in and he did that bit at the end,
yeah,
and the beginning.
So you got know, the bit, oh, I poke. See, yeah, yeah, I've got you, yeah, the sort of like the cry type thing,
yeah, because yeah. He hadn't done that and he'd done everything else we'd done, but he hadn't done the beginning and the end. So he did that and he said, right, now we're going to go and eat. And he said, oh, maybe we can have a barbecue here. Where can I get a lamb? Maybe we can. Cut a lamb up and cook it, and
nice
said, where can I go and buy one? So I said, well, you could try Harrods. I mean, we were just joking around, and we said, oh, try Harrods or something like that. And he went off trying to find a sheep, you know, a lamb or something. And we were going to cut it up, and Danny was there, obviously, going, yes, this is a good idea.
Oh, right, know. Yeah, of course. He would, yeah, yeah, exactly. Would do. Yeah, so, Daniel the drummer.
So they came back and they were really disappointed because they couldn't find
couldn't have a barbecue like
a lamb for us to cook. So we ended up going to the Chinese.
Oh well, that'll do, won't it? Yeah. Do that instead. Brilliant. Oh, that's
it's such one a of those throwaway barbecue things from the petrol station as well. 99p. All went to waste.
So yeah, stick a lamb on there. We should have a tune, shouldn't we? We've got some of your picks of your fave tunes. We can come on to those later on, Chris, if you want.
Yeah.
We've also
yeah,
got sure. some of your newer stuff as well. Because I say you've got. I mean, it's funny with the Dalek that, you know, you've got quite a back catalogue of collaborations, haven't you? Sort of with the Wolfmen and with the Mutants.
Yeah.
Oh
yeah, it's quite a lot, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah. Well, it's a great thing because you know, sort of.
Sinead O'Connor,
yeah, the Dandies and sort of Rat and stuff. So there's a whole history of sort of collabs going on. Annabella, Louina and stuff. But at the moment, you're sort of double whammied, aren't you? You're sort of, you know, you've got two things going on, two streams of music going on there. What with sort of Rude Girl and Rat and the Rat and the Rude Girl with Thousand Motels and Rude Girl, which you've won an award as well. Was it the PMA award?
PMA award in LA, which was. We won it the year before for the track that you were in the studio when we did it with Wilco and Wilco Wayne and Norman was on the bass. Do you remember? It was the track and Jake from Stiff Little Fingers was singing it.
Walking Wounded. That's right. That's a great track. And there's that was saying that. Yeah.
You were there, weren't you?
I was there, yeah, yeah, that's right, yeah, yeah, exactly. You messaged me, I think we knew it was going to be good nights on the way, when I arrived, you said, bring another bottle of gin down. it's about 6 o'clock in the evening, and I just got off the train, and I had to bring another bottle of gin, but yeah, it was great.
Wilco turned up, didn't it? And it was like, I'm glad you gave me the tip off about the gin, because we've got that couple of bottles in.
Yeah.
And Wilco turned up, and he'd been in the pub down the road where he used to play in. Mm. It was... I can't remember the name.
It's a big pub in Putney, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah.
On the corner. The theatre, which is a theatre, used to be a theatre pub as well. And he said he went in there for a drink first. So he turned up with his driver, or I can't remember.
It was his manager. I think it was Bob at the time.
Yeah.
Who lived on a boat. Yeah.
Yeah.
That's right.
So you remember, don't you? And then.
Yeah, I got lift home off him.
We had a pint of gin.
That's right. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And then he phoned Norman and said, Norman, you've got to come down. And Norman walked in with his bass around his neck.
Oh my God, Norman was like, and it was like weird because Norman's my hero. Norman is my hero, you know, right? And I remember sort of like thinking, oh, you know, Norman's got to play on this song. And I could see that we were kind of, you know, obviously that's his bass. So I said, so we got him down. And he came in, and he came in like with, you know, three girls or something.
He did, that's right, Mexican girls.
Two Mexican girls and what's the name?
Sophie.
Victoria. Is it Sophie? Yeah,
the bass player.
Sophie, the bass player. She and it was just like this amazing entry, and he was full of energy, and he was like, right, come on, let's do it sort of thing. And it was like, honestly, it was just, I've still got all the jams, you know, because we jammed.
Oh, amazing.
Yeah, this is Walking Wounded, recorded at Razor Studios. Jake Burns from Stiff Little Fingers singing, Norman Watroy on the bass, and we've got on the guitar Wilco Johnson, and
drums
is Rat Scabies,
yeah,
and Wayne Kramer from MC5.
It's a pretty solid lineup, isn't it?
Yeah, it's pretty good.
Here we go, let's hear it. Back in the room, fantastic work! What a walloper that is! Another one to pop the walloper alarm, Piley, isn't it?
Absolutely. I think if you didn't know that who was playing on that, I think you'd pretty much get that as Wilco, wouldn't you?
Yeah, you would actually. Yeah, yeah.
There's a touch of She Does It Right about it, isn't there?
Yeah,
his bits. It's a touch of She Does It Right.
There's definitely that feel-good vibe about that, isn't there?
Yeah, definitely.
Definitely South End, isn't it? It's suddenly sort of South End on it. It's something going
on. There's definitely, yeah, you're right, a bit that sort of seaside, Canvey Rock, the old Thames Delta sort of vibe about it, definitely. And what a combo. Like I think we said at the time, from Oil City to Motor City, wasn't it, with the Wilco and Wayne Kramer team.
Yeah.
So that really worked. That was brilliant stuff. And then you had another South End on the second Mutants album, Steve Weston.
Steve Weston, yeah, wasn't he on the...
The Tokyo...
Wasn't he on the first one as well? No, he wasn't, was he?
No, I think it was on the
Tokyo one. He was on the Tokyo one.
Is he involved?
And the new one.
I was going to say, yeah, what's the deal with? So he's on the new one as well, yeah?
Yeah, he's brilliant. I mean, like, he's like, you know, you get one of these people, like, who's really, really good. Like, everyone who's really, really good that I work with, mostly, they're not a pain in the arse. Yeah. They're just like, they're so straightforward.
Yeah.
And it's like, you know, you just sort of phone and we'll send them a text. Yeah, no problem. When? Tomorrow? Mm. Yeah, done. Mm. Fine. And that's it. And it's like so straightforward. He was, I mean, and then he's so sort of, he left that message, I don't know if you saw on Facebook, saying how much he loved it and everything. And, you know, so I, you know, I love working with people like, you know, him. He's a genius, isn't he?
Thanks for that, Dave. That's right. No, he's only been, you haven't actually been in the studio together, though, have you? You haven't actually sort of seen him?
No.
I mean, that's isn't it, Piley? Watching him play, it's a masterclass. Yeah. Stephen as well. I think we've all seen
him. You can't take your eyes off him, can you?
He's just, it's magic. Watch, you know, when you see like a real master craftsman at work. Oh, and wow. it's just incredible watching Steve at work.
It was weird that when he was playing with the broadcasters, and I mean, that was an incredible lineup, but Steve would be on the far side just doing his thing. We'd always try and get a seat over that side so we could just sit and, you know, you got the singers doing really? His stuff, the double bass players going. We were sort of always trying to be over where Steve was. He's just incredible.
Yeah, and he's so modest as well.
Isn't
he?
Yeah.
So how long has he been sort of, you know, is he sort of, were you sort of watching him when you were kids?
No, we came into about 10, 12 years ago, I guess, didn't we? But he's been playing since the late 70s. He was Eddie and the Hot Rods.
Oh, really?
Yeah, he was with the late period of Eddie and the Hot Rods. And then he was sort of with Wilco for a bit. And then he was in like a sort of blues band Rent Party. But then he plays when he's not playing with his own band at sort of, he plays the, you know, it's a blues club on Kingley Street. He plays there and the one in Shoreditch. Ain't nothing but the blues. Oh, okay. He used to have a residency there. But then he plays with Muddy Waters' son, Mud Morganfield. So he sits in with him, did Jules Holland with him as well. So yeah, he really knows his gear when it comes to the old harmonica. But
see all these things, all these harmonicas, because I see sort of like, he's got all these cases and all these amps and all these sort of mics, and you can tell he's like a real
know. And he strips them apart, I think, and engineers them, and he does sort of tricks with his harmonica. Like he dips it in wax and does bits like that and pulls it. He learned off of Lou Lewis. You remember Lou Lewis? He was another.
Lewis from is that from Dutch Deluxe? No,
I think he was Canvey Boy, part of the sort of feel good and Hot Rod sort of crowd. He played with Wilco a bit, but he taught Steve how to play, because again it's like one of these mad scenes, everyone comes from Canvey. I think he had about a week with him, said I can't teach him anymore. he just nailed it in a week. He's just incredible because his touch is amazing.
Because I remember sort of when we were sort of doing the drill stuff, you know, because it was in the, just between that pub rock and punk sort of thing that was happening, and Lou Lewis, Dutch Deluxe, and then, you know, Wilco's band,
Feel Good.
Feel Good and all that. But they're all those pub rock bands, and they used to play at, there was a pub called the Nashville.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And the Kensington, there was a place, and all those places there we used to go and see and play, where we used to play, actually.
Mm.
And sometimes we support them. But it was like that little crossover period. You're probably too young to
just
remember
just on the
that,
other side of it, yeah. But were you aware of a sort of change in the air then, when sort of pub rock was out and punk was coming in?
Yeah, for sure.
Right.
Yeah.
Had you had sort of long hair in the 70s and then sort of chopped it off? Did you have like a sort of an epiphany moment or something when punk arrived?
I'm trying to think. I did have long hair when I was a teenager. And then I guess I chopped it off. I don't think it was because of punk or anything. I just chopped it off because, I don't know, I just chopped it off. But it was like, it wasn't because of, I want to look like a punk or anything. And punk is in. But I do remember there was that sort of like a bit of rivalry, and there was that sort of, are you pub rock or are you punk? Because, and the Pogues were stuck right in the middle, because the Pogues, I was playing a lot of the Irish pubs at that time, and the Pogues were playing the same old shitholes as me, sort of thing, you know, a lot of Irish pubs. But it wasn't cool then. You know, that was like when it was just old Irish pubs with geezers in drinking. It wasn't like, this is not cool.
Yeah, yeah.
This is like, you're going to get your head kicked in.
Yeah.
You know, it's IRA. It was all sort of like very sort of, but also family, you know, so family stuff as well. But
putting the box around for the boys and that sort of thing.
Sort of thing. And it was, you know, it's very sort of, I mean, I did a lot, I guess I did my apprenticeship doing that sort of stuff, is, you know, putting on. I remember we were playing in the Kilburn High Road, and there was a place at the top called, I'm trying to think, there were two Irish gigs. And then I do one gig and I put on a red shirt, and then I go across to the other gig and I put on a green shirt straight after.
Costume change.
Yeah, no, costume changing, because it was like different, you know, politics. So you go across, and so it was the, my brain's gone, but it was, there were two gigs opposite each other up the sort of Kilburn High Road, and we used we used to play them. Massive, massive gigs, and you go in there. I mean, I had no idea what I was playing. They play, we do the Irish National Anthem.
Oh.
And I'll go like, I don't know if you've ever heard that.
I don't know if I have.
No, we'll try and learn the chords on that.
Did you, if there was a fight ever broke out in the pub, did you have a tune that perhaps calmed it down, or that everyone would get everyone back together again?
No, I mean, I guess what happened was, when there was fights, I mean, it was like pretty much, which was every night. I mean, there was like, you know, normally you'd go in there and there'd be a bloke with a broken nose straight away, the blood dripping out, and he'd just be sitting there, you know, like the whole thing. And then some fights would kick off, and I think we used to play some Johnny Cash, to calm them down.
Right.
You know, My Cry and Eyesore. I can't remember, like they play those old country.
Oh, I see. Well, that sort of stuff. Brilliant. So, and what about, was it sort of, when you first toured America, what was it like there? They were sort of violent, but they've got guns rather than fists, haven't they? Were you sort of nervous of that?
The first experience of guns was in Germany, because I was playing in American bases.
Mm-hmm.
One of the first jobs I did was playing the country band in American bases in Germany. And so, and this guy was like, I think we were playing like, you know, I can't remember what it was, but there was like a 3/4 waltz or something, like some country thing. And then some guy came running, GI running across with a gun, saying, "Oh, I'm going to kill you. I'm going to kill you." And he had a gun and he shot this guy.
No.
And he shot this guy. And the band leader said to me, "Just keep playing, Chris. Just keep playing."
Bloody hell.
And I was like, you know, a little kid, you know, on the bass. And I was going like, these old guys are about 30 in the band, you know. So,
God. Well, that is an apprenticeship, isn't it? You really have sort of worked through an apprenticeship, really, in a way, learnt your trade. Can play anything.
Yeah, it was like, I mean, I wanted to go to university, but I guess, you know, this is just the same.
So we're going to go for the new one. We'll take off. This is as we were saying, we just chatting about your sort of new stuff going on, Thousand Motels and Rude Girl. Go on, Chris. This is Like Wow.
Yeah, this is Like Wow by Rude Girl and CC. Let's have it. Look!
Over the limit, I'm so double vision. I just give what I'm giving. Fuck all your feelings. I'm here to kill it. I kill it with the rhythm, and I kill it when I sing it, and I kill it with the flows and the clothes and the swag, and I kill it with the lyrics. Give it all that I have, and I'm never gonna stop till I get what I'm after. Whoa, I just slow down the whole flow, look down like whoa. Yeah, don't let me into my zone now. I broke out of my hometown, so tell your bitch that I'm home now. Like whoa, like whoa. My limit, that my goal's double vision. I aim to win it, fuck all your feelings. I came to kill it. My flow is a lot, it never stops. Like I'm running upon a treadmill with the buttons pulled off. I'm as sick as a dog, a bulldog with a stick and a rock sticking in it. Yeah, I'm the fucking illest. Whoa, had to slow down the whole flow down like whoa. Yeah, gassed up, look, I broke down like whoa. Yeah, don't let me into my zone now. I broke out of my hometown, so take a bitch that I'm home now. Like whoa. Whoa, whoa, like, whoa.
that's a belter. Okay. That nips along, did it? That is brilliant. That is. How did that come about, Chris?
We had like Jenna, Rugo, okay, Rugo. We were just sort of we were writing. We just started writing, and I think she missed her train home, and we had like half an hour to kill. We did it in 10 minutes. I think I just, you know, we had a beat, whacked the beat up. I put some fuzz bass on it. Then I put, there's two twang guitars. Yeah, like if you listen to it, there's like left and right, two twang guitars, different, slightly different. And it's just a bass guitar. And then that's it, really.
Who hooked you up? Who put you together, you two?
Oh, that was years ago. That was you remember Gary, don't you? Yeah, you met Gary.
Is it Gary White or?
Gary Buxing. Gary Buxing.
I might have met him. Yeah.
At Sony. So we were at, when I was signed to Sony, we started working together. And she was only like, she was like a child sort of star, like 13 or something. And then she went into rehab at 14 or 15 or something. She disappeared for a while. And she talks about it, so it's fine. It's not like, you know. And so then, you know, like when she came out, I text her and she said, how are you doing? She said, I'm fine. And we just started working together. So, yeah.
Brilliant. Brilliant. So you've done a couple of EPs, haven't you?
Yeah.
So you've
we've done a couple of EPs, yeah. Mm-hmm. And the Clash stuff.
The Clash stuff, Guns of Brixton. Was it Long Black Cadillac as well? Should I Stay or Should I Go?
Yeah, we did. And also we did the That's Where the Hip Hop. Anthemic Hip Hop, the one that we won the award for, Helen Keller.
Helen Keller, that's right.
Yeah. So we've done quite a lot, and we've got an album coming out now.
Right, okay.
So it's quite, you know, it's quite a busy period.
It's amazing. So we'll just recap for anyone who might have come in halfway through. That is Like Wow. That's Rude Girl and CC. And that is, when's that coming out?
Sort of out, I think, I can't remember, right. Like, 4 weeks, 3 weeks time.
Okay, all right. So it'll be all across the socials. We'll get some.
There's a lot of stuff. We've got a lot of interviews and bits and pieces coming up. So, it's all good.
Digital release, Chris, or are there hard copies of this? Or?
There's going to be vinyl.
Nice.
But at the moment, yeah, there's going to be vinyl with the album. And then they're going to do some sort of, you know, some odd sort of vinyl. So, if funnily enough, I'm talking to them about that tomorrow because apparently it takes ages to get that stuff out and about. So,
huge waiting list now, isn't there? To get vinyl, everyone wants to press vinyl now, and there's not that many places in the big scheme of things you can get it done, and the waiting times are just getting longer and longer.
That's what he said. Yeah.
Perhaps that's why cassette's making a comeback. Cassette is dead.
But are they, when you say the cassette's back, it's not going to be like winding it back like you used to have.
With a pencil. No, I hope not. No, I don't know why it's coming back. I don't know. It's thinking about the comeback. It's bizarre. Yeah, cassettes will be mini disc next.
Well, it ain't no fun when the rabbit's got the gun.
dinner's ready.
That's a quality piece. And I've Let Go, I love as well. Let Go is such a great track, such an uplifting chorus on Let Go.
Oh, really? Yeah, it's going to be on the new EP.
Yeah, it really stands. Yeah, I mean, I love them all, but there's something about that one. She's quite confessional, the way she's just throwing everything out there. But then the lift, and you think, well, it's all okay now.
Great that you've got that. She'll be really pleased.
Yeah, it's really positive. I did a little thing for Viva on it. I don't know if it ever got published in, so I'm not sure what goes in and what goes out with Viva, but I'll send it to you anyway if you want to pull anything from it.
Oh, she'll be really, so, yes, please. Yeah, yeah. She'll be really chuffed you said that.
And then we've got a Thousand Motels is your project with Rat.
Yeah.
What are you two albums in now?
Yeah, we're on Getting Where You Fit in there. So that's with Sean Wheeler. I mean, there's a track on there, which the lead track is When the Rabbit's Got the Gun.
Yeah.
The first single. That's actually the first single. It's going out to radio now. I think it's had its first play this week.
Oh, okay. So he was on the Mutants album, wasn't he? The Desert album.
Sean Wheeler.
Yeah.
Sean Wheeler's singing on it. Yeah. So Sean Wheeler's featuring her on it, and he was on the Mutants' "Your Desert, My Mind."
That's right. It was Vultures, the track.
He was on Highway. Is it Highway 61?
Oh, well, the bluesy type thing.
Yeah, he's like, and a couple of other tracks on it, but he's amazing. I mean, honestly, Shirley's like, this album is a weird thing because it's a mixture of gospel, blues, funk, punk, the whole thing, and we've got choirs on it. So it was made between Memphis, London, and Palm Springs.
Has lockdown affected that? Because you can't travel, can you?
Well, we booked all our tickets. Booked the flights, we booked the hotels, we booked the studio in Memphis. And then they said, no, 2 weeks before.
No.
Yeah.
Oh, no. What a signal. But you got Palm Springs, though. You've got some hours
We did it. No, we did it all. Basically, we just did it by file transfer.
Oh, yeah, okay. Yeah. Right, got you. Did it that way. We'll backtrack. This is the first album, yeah?
Yeah.
Was this recorded in Brooklyn?
The first album was recorded in between Brooklyn and
Brentford.
Yeah.
Right, yeah.
Yeah, Brentford.
So from Brentford to Brooklyn. So.
Yeah. That's quite a good title, actually. Maybe we should call it that.
So here we go. So what are you saying? And there was Rain you'd recommend, yeah? Is the sort of gateway track to 1,000
Well, there's Rain, but the first track is the one that was being played on the radio, which is called I don't even remember what it's called now. What's the first track on the
Beautiful Losers?
That's it. That was the one that's everyone playing.
Oh, what's
so, that? So if you want to play that one or Rain, then
let's do, if everyone's playing Beautiful Losers, let's do Rain.
Reminds me of you, way back when I carried you.
This is Courtney Taylor Taylor of the Dandy World, and you're listening to Piley and Mondo's Podrophenia.
On Ship Full of Moms. www.shipfulofmoms.co.uk.
Oh, brilliant. That is fantastic. Is that you on harmonica as well?
Yeah, it's not exactly Steve Preston's.
No, it's pretty good. Does Rat play harmonica?
No, he just plays the drum. Oh, he plays bits and pieces, but...
He did a bit of guitar there, doesn't he?
I think he does, doesn't he? Yeah, I mean, it's funny because when we did... when we were doing that Tokyo album, we went to Japan, we were playing in Japan, and still we were playing that Tokyo, the Second Mutants album. We were playing it live, and we did Neat, 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 and we did New Rose.
Yeah.
And what's the one that starts with the bass line? I'm trying to think.
Oh, that's, is that Neat, Neat, Neat?
Yeah. Got that. And so I was playing it. Yeah. And he was like going, no, you're not playing it right. I was going, it's like all it is, you know. And he was like going, no, no, no. And he picked it up. And I don't know if you've heard it, but if you listen to it, it's like it's quite subtle because it's actually not doing what you think it's doing.
Oh, that's interesting.
Or maybe it was just me being deaf. But
it sounds a bit sort of Ramonesy, doesn't it? That sort of the way, yeah.
It's just that it's got this weird sort of little thing on the way that you play it. And Rat just picked it up and went, made me look completely stupid. Like it went like it wasn't the same, and it was like I was playing it. It was going that, and then I remember Paul was playing the guitar, and Seiji from Guitar Wolf came in.
Yeah. Oh, okay.
And Seiji said, "No, no, no," to Paul, downstrokes.
Did he?
And he said, and Paul was going, "Not having it." And Paul was going, "No," and then Rat said, "Yeah, it's downstrokes." So it was all sort of like you know. It's funny how those songs that sound so simple, they're actually sort of...
Exactly. I think I guess
it's like sort of playing Adam the Ant song.
So we were just saying, you were saying there was a way to play certain songs like the Adam and the Ant songs. What was it? Because you came in off following Gary Tibbs, didn't you?
Yeah, after Gary, yeah.
So, I mean, they were big Roxy fans as well, weren't they, Adam and Marco?
Yeah, it was. I think that's why they got him in, and it was... It was weird because they got him in because they were fans of Roxy. And then I don't know if you heard that album, but the album, what was the album called? I'm trying to think what it was called before.
That would have been Prince Charming, wouldn't it?
No, the album, the Roxy album, just before he joined. And what they didn't realise was the bass player was a guy called Alan Spenner, who was also, apart from Norman Watroy, he's my favourite bass player.
Really?
Oh, yeah. Alan Spenner.
I don't know him.
Alan Spenner. And he's dead now. He's dead now, but he was a complete alcoholic. And people couldn't understand how he could play the bass. Never. Like, he used to go to the sound check, and until he had a drink, he couldn't play. And if you listen to that album, is it called Manifesto?
Oh, Manifesto's great. That's got
Is it that album?
Yeah, it's got Angel Eyes on it.
I think it's that album.
It's got the shot of all the models and stuff, the mannequins on the front cover.
I think it's that one. It's the one, so it would have been the one before Gary Tibbs joined, so it would have been 81.
Yeah, that'd be about it, yeah.
And so they thought, because they love Roxy, they thought Gary, because Gary had got a name check on it, but actually it was Alan Spanner who played on it.
Oh,
and nice. So they employed him on that basis. And it wasn't like, obviously Gary's a great bass player.
Yeah.
And a really good bloke. And so obviously he did all the girls loved him. So he did a great job. And I think, you know, when the band came to an end, it was just, I think Adam and Marco had just sort of run the course with the bands sort of thing. So, and when I joined, it was still going to be Adam and the Ants. And when I did the audition, it was like Adam and the Ants. And I, you know, God knows, you know, all that stuff that goes on. But, yeah, so it was...
Because that's quite a jump to go from drill, where they're in punch-ups in Irish bars, to the pin-up band.
Yeah, no, it was.
Did you have to adjust your head, do sort of like mental adjustment to sort of make that switch?
Well, we'd done the Slade stuff, and we were supporting Aswad, so we were supporting, you know, like quite big bands, and so, and I'd done, as I, you know, as we said, my apprenticeship, so I was ready for it.
Right. But that's, you know, it must have been a whole different world, though, in a way.
It was, but, you know, I kind of like, I felt like, you know, time was slipping away.
Mm.
And I thought, all right, that's it. It's all over for me, you know.
How old were you then?
23. And I remember feeling so depressed. And like, I mean, the gutter for me was when we were rehearsing in Hendon in the drummer's basement, Ray Weston's basement. And Ray Weston is still drumming, but Scottish, you know, Glaswegian. And the whole house was full of Glaswegians, apart from Ray's girlfriend, who was this beautiful girl from Paris that we used to just all drool over, you know. Used to go in there and just smell her, and she was just like, she'd just walk around, you know, all us sort of young guys with no girlfriends, and like, you know, be just like sort of go down the pub and see what we can get sort of thing. It's like sort of, there's him with his exotic sort of French girl.
With your girlfriend, young Parisian.
That wasn't the gutter anyway, but the gutter was, we had this bloke called Hal Lindis with us, who was like an American surfer dude and playing guitar. And so we met up in the sort of smelly old basement, you know, really damp basement, just to rehearse after, you know, done another tour with Slade. And we were supposed to be supporting what were they called? The Ramones. They were coming over. So we booked to support them on their first tour. Then they cancelled their tour. So it was kind of like, that was a real gar. So then we went to the basement, and then Hal said he was going to join Dire Straits.
Oh.
And so I remember thinking, this is not looking good. So I was living in Essex. I was living in Walthamstow, I think.
Yeah.
So I think it's in Essex, isn't it? Yeah, so no, it's not in Essex, is it? No,
it's E17, yeah. It's close, though, on the border. Yeah.
So then, yeah, so I kind of like sort of thought, oh, it's all over. And then I thought, I've got to do something. And I looked in the adverts, you know, I felt very sort of like I was betraying my band, because it was my band.
Right.
But I looked in the adverts, you know, in the back of the NME and the Melody Maker, sort of for jobs. And it said, there was this sort of advert that said, bass player wanted, must be able to stand and deliver.
Oh, I see. Right. Okay. Have you still kept the advert?
No, I don't think so. It might be somewhere. I've got all the NMEs. It might be somewhere.
Yeah, but, someone will have it. If not,
yeah.
So if it originally was going to be Adam and the Ants, what happened there? What was the decision there to make it an Adam solo thing?
I think what happened was I went to the audition, and it was still going to be Adam and the Ants, and then, there must be some contractual reason, to do with if he'd have called it Adam and the Ants, that the band would have had, it was something contractual.
Right, okay. Yeah.
So he had to change the name. And so basically then it became Adam Ant, and, you know, I joined, and it was kind of like on the back of, I think I went to the audition, I went in this pink suit, I went in my yellow ex-GPO van, and I parked it around the corner so no one would see, and sort of went in with a pink suit on. And I thought, I knew the job was mine. You know when you get that
feeling? Yeah, you got the buzz.
And I knew it was mine. So I went in there, and it was all sort of, you know, very sort of, Marco was just sort of, it was in Nomi Studios, and they had this sort of spotlight. They had a sort of built a stage for themselves, and I was down in the pits, you know. Yeah. Some roadie came in, tuned my bass up, which I didn't like. And, you know, it's the first time I'd had a roadie tune my bass sort of thing. I thought, I can do it myself, and it is in tune, actually.
Thank you, yeah.
Well, it's always in tune, and it's my old Fender Precision. So anyway, so he sort of tuned it. It's a bloke called Stuart,
and he was really grumpy, sort of northerner bloke. I remember his sort of like, he just chucked it at me. So I thought, all right. So I was sort of playing it. And they said, right. And Adam said, what, right. And I thought I was going to be auditioning with a band.
Yeah.
So I learned every single back catalogue, you know, every single album. Dirt Wears White Socks.
Oh, my God.
Everything, all the backing vocals, everything. Wow. I said, well, so what? He said, oh, no, just play a bit of blues. So had a spotlight on me, and it was just like, play a bit of blues, play a bit of jazz. But what's it, by myself? He goes, yeah. So it was a bit of funk, a bit of reggae. And I felt like a right tosser, and I was just sort of like, and then, you know, honestly, if someone had filmed that, that would be embarrassing.
That's amazing. So, well, do you know, just to surprise you, you say that. So we're digging around in the archives here. So,
oh no,
no, we haven't. That was an Eamon Andrews moment. No, you're right.
Mm. Oh, amazing. And how long before you got the nod after that, after you did the rehearsal?
I think it was like Adam followed me out and I knew he was definitely interested. So I knew he was, I kind of got the feeling I'd got the job. And then I think it was a few months because they had, there was something going on, and there was some sort of, you know, some business stuff going on, and then so I thought, you know, it's all just falling a bit sort of thing. And then I got a phone call from I was married at the time, and I think it was Julie from Essex. She was from Ilford.
Oh, right, okay.
And yeah, and so I think Julie answered the phone and she said, it's Adam. And I've got a mate. I had a mate called Adam. And I said, I'll tell him to fuck off or something. And she said, no, it's Adam N. I said, oh, yeah, sure, sort of thing. So,
yeah.
And I answered the phone. He goes, all right, it's Adam N here. He says, how would you like to tour the world with me? And I said, yeah, sure, sort of thing. And I saw he was still sort of like messing around. And then he said, right. And he said, right, meet me in Tootsie's in Holland Park tomorrow for breakfast at 10 o'clock or something. And I said, all right. So I turned up at Tootsie's Holland Park. He was there, all sort of, you know, with his file of facts and very organised and, you know, sort of said, right, that's it. So this is what the job would entail. And then he said, and my manager's coming over in a minute to give you some money. And you'll get some money, going to give you some cash and then put you on a payroll, you know, give you bank details, start paying you money, blah, blah, blah. And I said, fine. And so I was very happy. Yeah. And we had an Eggs Benedict and a few cups of coffee. And
that was that.
And then I got on the sort of Victoria line or whatever it is back to Walthamstow. I think it's the Victoria line. Yeah, so I got back to Walthamstow. I went to the market and I bought a colour TV. So, and I went back and said, hello, Julie. I've got a colour TV for us.
That's so amazing.
Can you remember what your first thing you did with Adam? Like, was it a live show? What was your in the studios? Can you remember what your first thing you had to play with him?
Oh, well, in a rehearsal or live?
Yeah, either.
The first rehearsal was at Easy Hire in, I don't know if you remember that, it was in sort of North London. So it's just up from the Angel, in between the Angel and Camden. So it's along that road. I'm trying to think what it's called. There's still studios down there. So we did that Easy Hire and we were there and we turned up and so we turned up and it was like all sort of I'd never met anyone but the rest of the band, and we sort of turned up and Bob was there, and Bob had played on Goody Two Shoes.
Was he the guitarist?
Bob, he was the drummer.
Basically
he'd replaced Chris Hughes's drums on the number one hit for another business reason. So that so Bob was there and he played on Friend or Foe, I think. Yeah, Friend or Foe. And so we, Marco turned up, and then there was the Q-Tips brass section. There was a bloke called Char Burns from Fingerprints on guitar. and we played, and it sounded rubbish. I mean, honestly, I was like, you know, coming from the drill,
yeah,
like we were super tight, and like, and we played together every day. This sounded absolutely rubbish. I mean, I was like gobsmacked. And then Adam came in, and it just sounded awful. And I just thought, fuck me, this is like, sorry, I shouldn't be saying this, should I? No, and I just thought, like, I really did think that that was the end of it, sort of thing. And then Adam was really happy with it. Blimey. And so was Marco. So me and the guys went to the pub, and we said, oh, that was interesting, sort of thing. And so, but then I didn't, you know what it was I wasn't used to sort of, you know, because I was used to being in a band that played every day, and I didn't realise that, you know, and then we played for a few weeks, and then we got onto a stage, and suddenly it all came to life. It was like a natural organic process of building into a band. So I wasn't used to sort of this thing. So I thought, immediately I thought it was going to be rubbish, but it turned out to be really good.
What was it you were touring? What was the album you were touring?
We were doing, it was after Goody Two Shoes was the hit at the time.
Right.
So I think it was Friend or Foe was the, I think Friend or Foe was the first album. So yeah, Friend or Foe. And then the first gig we did was for the fans at that that Astoria place.
Oh, the Astoria was a great venue. That was a really good venue.
And that's where we made the video, you know, in that little alleyway.
Yeah, yeah, I know. Oh, yeah, down the side. What, that's the Friend or Foe video?
Yeah.
Where's
that's the Desperate but Not Serious.
Desperate but Not Serious, where you got all the sort of smoky, like the boxer sort of vibe in there.
Yeah.
Ah, well, I never knew that. Rock and roll. Should we have an ounce track? You've chosen an ounce track, haven't you? You've got B-side Babies, haven't you?
Yeah. That was the one we did with Tony Visconti, yeah.
Yeah, now that in the studio, he says it's the Thursday, Sunny. So is that Good Earth Studios? This is Tony Visconti Studios.
Yeah, just opposite the French House. Dean Street, yeah.
Yeah, I think Bobby recorded Scary Monsters there. Loads of albums have been recorded there. But I think I didn't realise until last year, I think, or before lockdowns at French House, and just saw it as Good Earth. And so, of course,
yeah,
it's opposite Bar Italia, which I think was that where the very Viva Rock.
Yeah, that was just up the road. Yeah,
it's up the road. Yeah, let's hear. And this, we'll come on to the names because you were rechristened after the back of this one. But let's hear B-side Baby.
Great.
We'll let Adam introduce it, I think.
Good morning, there, listeners. And here we are in sunny Soho on a Thursday morning. It's 12:22, and I think who's that coming into the studio right now? My God, it looks like. Looks like Marco. Oh my God, it is Marco. You ready, Marco? Yeah. Who's there next to him? Chris De Niro. You ready, Chris? Yeah. Cat Mitchell, you ready? Buckle my shoe.
There we go.
Great song.
That is a great track, isn't it? It's funny hearing that back with Adam's voice. He's got that sort of English tone, and he sounds—he doesn't do an American accent on there.
It's just—it's funny because that was we'd finished, we'd done the album Viva La Rock, and we were set up, and we sort of finished it really quickly, the album, so we had studio time left, and said, "Oh, should we just knock out some B-sides?" And I said, "Yeah." We all said, "Yeah." So we were set up. So those were recorded live. So right. Adam just shouted out the chords sort of before. And we just played them in one, really.
That's brilliant. It's I mean, that riff at the beginning is fantastic as well. It's a great riff.
Yeah.
Really good riff. And his voice, I mean, he sounds like he could have been in musicals with his voice in a funny way. Hearing it back, it's such a Anthony Newley or someone about his voice. You
he's
know,
a good singer, isn't he?
Yeah.
Hearing it back, I realised what a great voice and what a, you know, a good singer he was. You know, how did you sort of, you know, I want to say, how did you find him to work with? Was he sort of, you know, okay, cool, or?
Yeah, no, I mean, we just sort of on that album we did. He was like really sort of he wanted it to be a band, and he said, "Right, this is we're a unit now," and it's like he wanted to be like the Clash, you know. And he was like, "Okay, when we you know, I'll do all the backing vocals with him." So me and him did like all the backing vocals on that, and then he would say when we're on stage, sort of he had this whole thing of like when you watch the Clash or the Sex Pistols live, they stand really, and you're doing TV shows, they stand really close to each other.
Okay,
and
right.
It looks and it looks really good when, you know, for the TV point of view, the cameras, and you're all on the mic singing. And he had this whole sort of, he was really sort of, what's the word, intuitive, yeah. smart about everything, sort of, you know. And before we did that album, he gave me a reference tape, which was a Tempo Tudor album.
Oh, yeah, right. Of course, right, yeah. It's all 2,000 men, you're right, okay.
Yeah, and he gave me that, and he said, he didn't say anything, he just said, "Listen to that." And that's the way, he wasn't like, "Oh, do this and do that." It was more like, you know, an influence by giving you a book, or like saying, I don't know, very subtle, not controlling.
That's easier then, isn't it? I guess that gives you a bit more room to move as well, you can breathe a bit. Rather than feeling like you're smothered with someone else's ideas. And he sort of renamed the band. Was that sort of like a gang's idea then with the Clash, that he was renaming people? Because you were Chris De Niro, weren't you?
Yeah. I mean, he sort of, I think what happened was when I joined the band, I was quite thin. I was running a lot. So I was like really thin. And then we did our first Top of the Pops, and I was going through like, you know, like some weird pit. I tried to cut my own hair. And it didn't work out.
It never does. Like, a lot of people found out in lockdown.
I had a couple of drinks. And so I just sort of like started chopping it. And then I ended up sort of like chopping it all off. So I thought, well, I might as well just shave it. You know, just so it was like very short.
Yeah.
And then I had to go into a barber's and get a sort of number one or number two all over. And then I had to go next day. He said, "Oh, we got Top of the Pops." Or something. I said, "Oh, for fuck's sake, you could have told me that a couple of days ago." But they never told me anything. You know, I guess maybe they only found out that day.
Right,
or
yeah.
But I just got told they were doing Top of the Pops, we were doing Puss in Boots.
Oh, right, yeah, yeah.
And he said, just turn up. And I said, well, and I was wearing, I put a hat on because I didn't want him to see. I thought I'd get the sack, you know, if I turn up.
So put a hat on.
So I put a hat on and we were sort of in a lift coming down. He goes, he said, I haven't seen you with a hat on before. And I said, no. So I took it off. I said, you're not going to sack me, are you? And he laughed. He goes, oh, you look like Robert De Niro now. Oh. In Taxi Driver.
Right, right. There we go. That's where it comes from.
Yeah.
Oh, brilliant. It's amazing. It was so intuitive like that as well. You sort of really sort of studied it as a bit of a craft then, I guess, didn't he?
Yeah.
And he wouldn't have YouTube or loads of stuff to reference. He must have, I don't know where he'd have pulled it from.
I'd never even heard of Robert De Niro. And it was weird because I remember sort of at the time, you know, sort of, you know, it was kind of like, I think when I was in Walthamstow, it was like, I never really had, you know, like girls coming on to me or anything like that. And I remember sort of, you know, it was like, and I was married as well. And I remember this one girl came up to me and she said, oh, you look like Robert De Niro. Do you want to come to the movies with me and watch Deer Hunter or whatever it was, or Taxi Driver? Yeah. And I said, I don't know who Robert De Niro is. And I said, I'm married. And I was like, it was so weird. And I remember sort of like thinking like, because I was so naive back then. It was so weird, you know, so odd.
At that age, again, it's nuts, isn't it? No, if you look back and stuff, you don't realise how young perhaps you were at the time, because you feel so much more, you sort of, once you get past your 20s, you feel, I remember certainly my 20s myself, feeling like an old boy. Once you sort of move out the clubbing scene. But of course, you look back and think, I was so young. So
well, I guess
it's all relative, isn't it?
Yeah, I think it was, relative, isn't it? Yeah.
So with, and of course, Tony Visconti did the, was the last album, Viva La Rock? Was that the last album you did with Adam?
Yeah, that was Viva La Rock. And I loved working with Tony. He was like really sort of, he said, all right, we turn up at 11 and we'll work till 7. He was going through that, that Est period at the time, you know, the sort of positive thinking course. I think they call it something else now. Mm. But and the whole, his girlfriend and the whole studio. So we turned up at 11, everyone was really happy. And hello, you know, it's all sort of. And then Adam turned up late and Tony wasn't very happy and pulled him into a room. We heard a lot of shouting. Oh. And then Adam came out white faced and like said, I've never been shouted at. I was only 10 minutes late. He was going like, so anyway, so that was the start of the whole session. And then, we got on with it. It was all very sort of quick. And then 1 o'clock was lunchtime. Sort of went and had a sandwich up to Bar Italia or whatever. You know, I used to go in there. The guy, Tony, the younger guy, who's the son, he used to give me, I said, oh, can I have an espresso? And he goes, what, the special? I go, yeah. So he gives me the double espresso with cognac in.
Oh, lovely.
So he'd go like, Chris's special. So he'd do a little special. So I'd go in there and go back to the studio. We'd carry on. 7 o'clock, whatever was happening, Tony would whack his suitcase down and go, that's it, we're finished. Seriously? Get on his BMW bike, off he'd go, yeah.
Well, I never. And how was Adam? Did he mind if you were drinking or if anyone had a drink or sneaky sip or anything, or was he cool about that?
With me, he was, to be honest with you, Adam let me do anything. He was like, he liked me, I think. Mm. I know he liked, we was sort of like, we got on really well. So
that's good.
I think, and I didn't sort of make a habit of drinking sort of a lot. You know, I didn't really drink. I drink a lot, but not while I was working.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, like it was double cognac every now and then sort of thing. But Adam was like, you know, he kind of quite liked it. You know, it's kind of like, you're a real bloke, you know, you're a real geezer, not some session player, you know.
Yeah, so. Yeah, exactly.
Are you still in touch with Adam, Chris?
No. No, I haven't seen him since. Last time I saw him was in Soho, and he was playing, do you know that Soho festival they do every year?
No, I don't know that.
Yeah, it's, they do it every year.
Sort of save Soho thing, is it?
No, I don't know what it is, but they do. It's in Frith Street and it's outside Bar Italia, and they have a stage.
Yeah.
And I was just walking through Soho and I heard someone playing Prince Charming. and you know, on a guitar, and it sounded like, I thought, oh, some busker or something. So I kind of walked up, you know, Old Compton Street, and I walked into Fifth Street, and there was a little stage set up outside Bar Italian. It was Adam, and he was like, you know, with a couple of Italian guys, you know, he just met.
Yeah.
And they were playing it, and he was shouting out the calls to them, and, you know.
Did you jump on, have a go?
No, I just stood. I was with someone, I think. And I remember sort of like standing there, and I was looking at him, and he goes, and he looked at me, and he goes, "All right, Chrissy boy."
Oh,
and,
right. He goes,
and he goes, he says, "I'll see you later," sort of thing.
Oh, brilliant.
And then, so anyway, so it came off, and then Baratelli, Tony and all the guys, they were going to me. What I was standing outside because I was thinking, well, you know, I'm not really part of what's going on. Mm. I didn't want to impose myself. Mm. And Tony said, "What are you doing outside? Get in, you know, get in the party," sort of thing. So I went in, and Adam was there. And he goes, all right, Chris. Like, we just, you know, it'd been a couple of years, you know.
Yeah.
And he's, it was just like we'd seen each other yesterday. And he was just getting some food. He said, like, we were just backstage getting some food together. And we were just sort of getting some food, you know, Italian food, you know, having a drink. Yeah. And then joking around, you know, taking the piss, you know, a bit of a joking around. And then I think, I'm trying to remember what happened. Then his manager came up to me. He was with someone. And he goes, oh, you know, and Adam had left, and he said, "Oh, do you fancy going for a drink?" I said, "Well, is this a date or what?" No. He said to me, "You know," he said, "Adam wants me to ask you a couple of questions." I said, "Really?" I said, "What is this thing?" Sort of CID sort of thing, you know. It's like, so anyway, I think we went to the pub, French House or something like that, and he said, "Oh, Adam was wondering if you want to play with him again, you know, go on tour with him."
Blimey.
Yeah. And I said, "Well, what is the deal," sort of thing, you know, "what, how long, what, blah, blah, blah." And he goes, "Oh, he just wanted to suss out if you're into it." I thought, yeah, you know, I'll be up for it if, you know, if you tell me what it is. You know, if I know what it is.
Yeah, yeah.
But in theory, I think he was just trying to suss out if I was
I think I remember once you were saying he'd heard some of the Wolfmen stuff and he really liked it or something, didn't he?
Yeah, he loved it.
Yeah, yeah. That's right. That might be the first album or the second album. Probably the first album, I think. It might have been the second was being recorded.
Yeah.
I think you're saying he's making some really positive noises about it as well.
Yeah.
You know, which is brilliant stuff.
Yeah.
Had you parted ways with Adam by the time you did the old Save the Gorilla?
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh, you're not got a place on that one.
They get the royalty, the PRS coming on that. So,
I was telling my daughter about it because... my daughter's like early 20s and just loves everything 80s sort of thing.
Yeah.
And she's a huge Adam and the Ants fan. And I was saying about that, so, and she just thought I was winding her up when I said about it. And so I had to dig it out. I found it on YouTube and dug out the lyrics as well. She couldn't believe it.
Is there a tour jacket for it as well?
What's that?
Is there a tour jacket for it? Yeah. No, I think you know the story on that, don't you?
No, go on.
You know what happened. So no, it was like Adam had called me up, and he called me up and he was just like sort of, he said, "Oh, we're going to meet in Camden Lock." And I said, "All right." So he said, "Meet me at 3 o'clock. That was it, you know. So I said, "All right." So I went up to Camden Lock 3 o'clock on a Saturday or whatever it was. And, I was waiting around and there was no one there. And I thought, well, it's just, you know, Camden Lock. So I'm standing around. So I went down, you know where Dingles is?
Yeah, yeah.
I don't know what it's called now. So I walked down that road and it's like a dead end if you walk down that road. But there was a dustbin on the corner. Remember, there was a dustbin. So I walked down this road. Then I walked back again and I heard a mobile ringing. So it was in the bin. So there was a mobile ringing in the bin. So I stuck my head in the bin and then someone jumped on top of me. And it was like this old woman jumped on top of me. And I said, "What the fuck are you doing?" And we sort of fell on the floor. I was running around the floor. It was Adam dressed as an old woman. And he got dressed up and he was like wrestling with me on the floor. And then I said, "Oh, it's you!" And he's going, "All right, and he, I've got you." And we're just laughing, bloody joking hell. Around.
That's
and then he said, "All right, we're going to have a party." And then we went for. He started drinking. He'd never drunk before, so he started drinking. And he said, "Right, we'll go for a drink." I said, "Well, I wasn't drinking at the time."
Right.
He started drinking.
Would you believe it? Yeah.
So we went up the. Is it the Spread Eagle? You know, when you walk up.
Yeah.
What's that pub on the corner of the? You know, the Dublin Castle on the right. So the Spread Eagle on the left. So we went in the Spread Eagle. It was an off license on the right. So we went in there, and he bought like a sack full of. Anything like all this drink, and he bought like a piece of art, and there was an art shop there for 2,000 quid. He bought that.
Oh my god!
And then we went into the Spread Eagle, and he said, "Right, we're gonna have a celebration party tonight because we're getting a new band together, called what was it called? It was going to be called Blue Black. I can't remember." Blue Black something or other. I can't remember what it was called, but it was Uber Punk. That was Uber Punk. And the album was going to be called Blue Black Hussar or something.
That's
what it's. Yeah.
He did use that title in the end, didn't he? On that last.
Yeah, album. It's weird, but this is like way before then. And so so we went back to his flat, and he sort of said, "Oh, I'm going to go to sleep now. You can just crash out." He took his clothes off and he just sort of went in his bedroom and he said, "You can crap." I said, "I'm going to go to the gym." Because, you know, I was kind of like I was in my fit period. He said, "Right, well, I've booked out Bar Italia. We're going to have a big party tonight. So, big celebration. And I'll see you tonight at Bar Italia." So, anyway, I mean, I can go on forever. I'm going
to be
here all night.
Did he do a costume change or was he still in the old lady gear when he turned up?
I know he turned up like proper Adam Rockstar, and so we had a proper night out. Brilliant. And stuff. And and then how did this start off?
Because I was going to say save the gorilla.
Yeah. So basically, so what happened was he then got sectioned like a few days later, and I went up.
I wonder why.
I thought he was just happy. So he got sectioned, and then he called me up. He said, "I'm in Hampstead Looney Bin, come and get me out." So I went up there. Oh, it was a nurse that answered, and it was like a coin box. It's got Stuart Goddard on the phone. And he said, "Come and get me out, Chrissy boy. You know, they've locked me up." And so I went up there at Hampstead, and he said, "All right, you know." And he said, "Oh, you know, they've set me up and blah, blah, blah." And he said, "I've got a couple of guitars." And he said, "We're going to do a gig." And he gave me a set list. And it was like one of the old set lists that we used to do. And I said, and it was the inpatients all there and sort of the nurses. And I said, "You're joking, aren't you?" I said, "You know," and he said, "No." So anyway, went out there and they were all sitting out there. And we had the two guitars. And we sat up next to the piano. And I just remember him sort of like, I thought he's being serious. And we just sort of, he said, "Right, okay, let's go." And I think we started with Stand and Deliver or something. Yeah. And no, he stood up on a chair first. And he said, "Right, if any of you people in the RRA, you can fuck off." And he said, and there's any junkies, you can all fuck off too. And then stood down and we went into, and he was recording it like one of those micro cassette things. And so we started with Stand and Deliver, and then we got up to Goody Two Shoes, and the nurse came up and said it was his medication time. So he basically had to go off and had some medication. He said, "Carry on playing the riff, Chrissy Bruce." I was playing the Goody Two Shoes riff. He went off, came back. And it was just like weird, like an acoustic gig.
Crazy.
Yeah, all
times.
Recorded. So someone's got it somewhere.
Wow, mate. That's amazing. Yeah. On the gigging thing, how did, in the days of pre-mobile phones and when you could record and you were in contact, because those tours are really big old tours you'd have been doing then, and other bands, how did they organise it and keep it all together without mobile phones? How did not someone go wandering off and get lost? Or
I think what the tour manager used to fine you.
Right. Oh, I see.
So basically, if you didn't turn up on time, you were either left behind or you get fined. It was very strict, sort of, you know. you know, he comes up, you basically, this is the time you have to be here, this is the time you have to be here. You had a bit of paper and you'd write the number down. So if you got pissed and you went out, you had a day off, you'd write down your address, what time you had to be back again. Right. So, you know, when you woke up, wherever you woke up, you know, you knew you had to make it back to so-and-so.
And you had to be there to make your own way one way or another. You had to be at that point at that time.
Yeah, and if you were late, they'd just leave you.
No. You'd have to do it yourself.
Yeah.
And things, you know, that's incredible, really, isn't it? You know, did they give you a straightener at the talk? Did they give you a bit of a tough talk at the beginning? Or, you know, were different bands or different tour managers different in the way they approached one of these big sort of tours?
Oh, yeah, they were very strict.
Were they?
Very strict. Oh, yeah. Very strict. So it was like sort of, sorry, I'm just trying to see if the cat's killed something. It's making one of those noises.
Oh, right.
It's
time for its medication.
Yeah, maybe it's time for its bloody... Right, it's probably someone outside getting murdered. But they were very, very strict. And I remember when we were in... where was it? San Diego. San Diego, and me and Marco wanted to go down to Mexico because we had a few days off. And so we hired a car and we went down to Tijuana.
Blimey.
And he said, as soon as you go down there, you're not insured.
Oh, wow.
No.
Yeah, he said, so you go on your own, you know, steam. You know, if anything happens to you, tough shit sort of thing.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. All bets are off.
So we went down there and and as soon as we crossed the border, everyone had moustaches and, like, it was sort of suddenly changed into, like, it was like a classic sort of, you know, it was real sort of, like, you know,
yeah,
like this. And we went across and went into this bar and there were donkeys and, you know, all that stuff that you hear about.
Yeah, yeah, painted donkeys.
Know. Yeah, and it was all going off, kicking off. And we went into this bar and someone recognised Marco in Tijuana. and it was just really funny. So, yeah, they were strict. Like, when we were in the desert, like Joshua Tree, he said, oh, if you go down there, all those junkies and all that, and that's where, you know, Zed Leppin, the guy, the manager, buried someone. Someone got killed and they buried him in the desert.
Wow.
He said, you're not insured. So, yeah, they were really tough.
Blimey, so you really had to keep on the line with it then.
Oh, yeah.
What was the gym? I remember you telling me once, I don't know if you heard this part, there was a gym, you were saying there was a tour and Marco was retired. And and he wasn't going to play. And there was a guitarist. The guitarist pulled a bit of a stunt, didn't he, and broke his wrist.
Oh, yeah. Brighton, yeah. That was on Annie Nightingale's birthday. I think that's recently. That's just, that was like, that might be, actually, I'll look at my time. It's actually very soon. Or it might be now or a few days ago. But Annie Nightingale's birthday, and she lives in Bryant. She lived in Bryant, and it was her birthday. And we were playing at Bryant, and we were staying at that hotel that the IRA bombed. Can't remember what it's called now, you know,
the big one.
So we're down there. Yeah, the big one. And we'd done the gig and we came back and the guitarist, Charlie Burns, who was from Fingerprints, a Glaswegian, liked to drink. So he was like, there was a sort of painting of the Queen up there and he wanted a picture of his cock out next to the Queen, you know. So he piled all these chairs up and, you know, it's like, and so all the roadies were there. He wanted a picture with his cock out in the Queen's mouth sort of thing. So basically, I wasn't there. Like, I'd gone out to...
In a tasteful way,
And so he wanted a photograph of that. So apparently, I'd gone off clubbing at this point. So I was off clubbing somewhere. So this is what I heard. So then I got back and the atmosphere at the hotel was like, you know, it's like 3 or 4 in the morning. So it was like, and then there were a few people, roadies around, and they said, oh, have you heard what's happened? I said, no. And they said, oh, Charles broken his arm. And I said, what happened? And they told me the story. I said, you're joking, aren't you? And they said, no. And then
what happened? How did he break it? What happened?
He fell off the chairs, didn't he? So he fell off the chairs and then he broke it and they took him to the hospital. So then Char walked in as I was there with his arm in plaster.
Oh, no.
And I said, oh, what the fuck? I said, you know, and then So anyway, so next day, we got on the tour bus and we were supposed to be, you know, we had a next gig was Portsmouth. Mm. I can't remember where it was, somewhere. And Adam was pissed off, like really pissed off. So, and we stashed a load of drink on the tour bus, you know. You know,
after all the strict rules. Yeah.
So we'd hidden it all and we'd had a sort of like boxes and boxes of all this booze. And the tour manager came out and he was just pouring it down the drain. And we were sort of outside. Oh, no. All this booze was being pulled down the drain. And then Adam walked on with his Dr. Gloom glasses on. He had these sort of glasses that he used to wear when he was in a bad mood.
Oh, God.
And he just walked in the tour bus and he sort of walked straight through. I thought, fuck.
Oh, God.
And then he went straight to his bunk and he came out. He said, right, can you still play, Chuck? He goes, I don't know.
Mm.
He goes, right, well, we'll find out when we get to the gig on the sound check. So then, you know, we got to the sound check. It was really tense, you know, it was, you know, horrible, really. Mm. And then he said, they'd obviously called Marco, who thought he'd retired, and said, you better get down here just in case. So Marco turned up. And so Marco was there. And
he was
so
back in.
He was back in. I mean, he could play, but Adam obviously sort of felt like he should be back in. But Marco came on for the last three songs. So he came on for like the encores.
Oh, I see. Right. So he did it that way, took the heat off that way.
Blimey, yeah. So he just, you know, it was just there just in case. And then he came on for the encores, which suited Marco. So,
The burning question is, though. Did he get that picture before them chairs go away?
Someone's got it.
Someone's got it somewhere. At least it wasn't all in vain.
Do you know what? I'm going to write down a note because I think I know he's got it here.
Oh, there we go. The Apodrophenia exclusive.
I've got, actually, there's Glenn, who was from Walthamstow as well.
Mm.
And there's Leslie, who's from Leeds, who was the wardrobe girl. So Glenn, Leslie, they're going to be the ones.
Someone will have
who
it.
Might have it. Yeah, there'll be someone who's got it.
Let's hope he's not just his boots up in the air as he takes a tumble. Let's have like, a full action shot. Do that. So we've got 10 minutes left. Should we close up with a couple of tunes? What do you want to do, Chris? You got anything you want to say?
Up to you.
Or do you want to carry on with stuff? Or do you want to do a couple of... That's it. Well, you pick a couple of tunes. You've chosen some. I mean, you can pick anything you want. You can go from anything you played on, anything you... Those five that you chose, a couple of tracks you chose earlier on.
Well, what about Ride a White Swan by T-Rex?
Let's do that and we'll come back. What's so special about the Ride a White Swan? Why is that one of your picks?
Well, you know, it's like that age when you sort of, you know, that special age, isn't it? Where you're just sort of in your bedroom, your mum's bedroom, your parents' bedroom, doing those things that you do at 13 or 12. You know,
tennis racket in front of the mirror.
Yeah, that sort of thing. Yeah. Yeah.
Let's play the tune where it gets too dodgy.
You don't want to hear about that. Man.
Oh, go on.
No, I can't tell you about that stuff. Her name is Deborah.
Ride it all out like a bird in the sky. Was ride it all out like you were a bird. Fly it all out like an eagle in the sunbeam. Ride it all out like you were a bird. Wear a tall hat like the druid in the old days. Wear a tall hat and a tattooed gown. Ride a white swan like the people of a bell chain. Wear your hair long, babe, you can't go wrong. Catch a bright star and a place it on your forehead. Say a few spells and baby, there you go. Take a black cat and sit you down your shoulder. And in the morning you'll know all you know. Wear a tall hat like like a druid in the old days, wear a tall hat and a tattered gown. Ride a white swan like the people of a belting. Will you along, baby, can't go wrong.
That's such a great track. It's still, it's timeless. It glitters all this time on, doesn't it? It really does.
And it's weird, isn't it? Tony Visconti produced that as well, didn't he?
I know, exactly. Done the full loop. And yeah, exactly. It's amazing. What a great job he did on that. He could have been no Asian as well when he did that. So did you actually have a physical copy of that?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, there was nothing else, was there? So I just said vinyl. I think I have the poster on my wall. You remember the poster?
Was that in the field?
Electric Warrior.
Oh, that was, yeah, yeah, cool. Oh, yeah. Silhouette.
The black and white. I think it was black and white, yeah. That one. And then I had the Who, I had Jimi Hendrix. I mean, they were my three sort of posters. Oh, and the Faces.
Oh, I love the Faces.
And the Stones, Exile on Main Street. Do you remember all those postcard things? Exile,
I think we were saying the other day, Steve, about this. Exile's probably my favourite Stones album.
Same here.
I love it. And it sort of dropped through the cracks, didn't it? Didn't really get the heat it deserved. And you heard it. It was like just he'd walked into some sort of weird voodoo spell.
Yeah, it was amazing. I mean, and that Faces, the first Faces album, I think, was it Not As Good As A Wink To Point? Was it that one? I can't remember. No, what was it? First Faces.
First one, I think, is it First Step or something like that, where it's got Ronnie Wood holding the guitar book on the front?
Yeah, but that was so good.
Not As Good As A Wink has got Stay With Me on it.
Okay, I can't remember which one it was, but I remember sort of listening to it and thinking, like,
yeah,
this was really good. And then they used to do those plastic, you know, like vinyl, those in the NME, they'd have those plastic sort of vinyl, you know, what's it called, that Barry does. You know,
picture discs.
They used to, like plastic sort of vinyl. So it'd just be like, so when you got your NME or your MM, you know, Melody Maker, you'd have a sort of a flexi disc.
Oh, flexi disc.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Oh, flexi disc. Yeah, that's right. Yeah, yeah, cool.
You see, just put those on. I remember, and I had one with Backstreet Love On by
Curved Air.
Mm. And then that's on the other track. Side, yeah. And then on the other side was that three Groundhogs.
Oh, brilliant. Tony McPhee. Yeah.
Tony McPhee and all that. Yeah. So, yeah, no, it was an interesting period, sort of all that stuff.
That's brilliant. Go on, Chris. What do you want to? We'll finish out with your. We must say, huge salutes, huge tips of the Podrafina hat to Chris. It's been an absolute blast.
Absolutely flown by, hasn't it?
What are you going to say, Piley? What's your question?
Well, I just got. I've been curious about this for like 35 years, whatever it is. You know, like when you go to a gig, and like, especially when you it's like a charity thing, or there's multiple bands on, or whatever, and they come on and they set all the instruments up for the next act, and they're sellotaping the set lists on the floor and all that. Did they sellotape a set list for Live Aid with one track?
Very good question, that, actually. You know what? I think they had there was a set list.
And really?
I think there was a set list for four numbers.
Oh, because right.
I think that we were supposed to do four numbers. Right. And I think, just in case everything sort of turned around. You know, you have to be prepared, don't you?
So, fair enough. Yeah, just imagine a set list with one song written on it.
Yeah, it's chill. You know, tuning up, getting the outs walled up.
That's quite funny. Yeah. No, I mean, it would be quite anal to do that, wouldn't it? I mean,
yeah. the world's smallest set list.
That's quite funny. Oh, yeah, Chris, the bass player. He's only got four strings. You better write that number down for him.
Sorry, yeah.
Viva La Rock.
Yeah.
Fantastic.
Okay.
You're going to play us out then, Chris?
Yeah, go on. Yeah, do you want to, what do you want?
What I fancy, would you? I mean, we can either do Roadrunner by Jonathan Richman or Toots and the Maytals.
Entirely your show, whatever you fancy.
54, 46. Up to you guys. I'm up to either of those, whichever works for your show best, really.
We've got 54, 46 lined up, so let's do that.
All right.
And then, so huge suits to Chris, huge suits to Stephen Hastings for doing the pulling the faders and doing the Mike Mansfield for us up in the control tower there in the gallery. And a massive hoist of the hat to Hubsy, King of the Jingles.
Oh, absolutely.
Can I just say one more thing, though?
Go on.
I'd like to thank Carl Peel at Universal Music for all this sort of, you know, he's the one that made all these records happen, you know, like the Rhythm and Punk Review, Tokyo, everything. He's been the one behind all commissioning all of these. So I'd like to give him,
dedicate this to him then.
All right, Carl Peel.
Sing it up, mister! Hear what I say, sir, Get your hands in the air, sir! Woo! Then you will get no hurt, mister. No. I said,
Mondo's Podrophenia.